I'd like to invite you now to open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 15. And I apologize if I'm disappointing all of the mothers for not having a specific Mother's Day message today. The reason why I chose not to is because we're fairly quickly in our study in 1 Kings going to be coming across a very model queen that we can learn many lessons from. And this is Queen Jezebel. And we will learn many things of how not to be a wife and a mother. So, and by the way, dads, our day is coming up, and Ahab tags right along with Jezzy. So we're going to get enough of that, I think, here in the near future. So we'll continue on with our study of the text this morning. Starting in 1 Kings chapter 15. Verse 25, we're going to look at sinners in the hands of a sovereign God this morning. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 25. Now Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel 2 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in his sin, which he made Israel sin. Then Baasha, the son of Ahijah. Now remember, we've already had a prophet named Ahijah, and this is a different Ahijah. Baasha, the son of Ahijah, the house of Issachar, conspired against him. And Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon. So Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. It came about as soon as he was king, he struck down all the household of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive. Literally, did not leave to the house of Jeroboam anyone that had breath. He did not, he did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive until he had destroyed them, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. And because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he sinned, and which he made Israel sin, because of his provocation, with which he provoked the Lord God of Israel to anger. Now the rest of the acts of Nadab and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, became king over all Israel at Tirzah and reigned 24 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he made Israel sin. Now the word of the Lord came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha, saying, "Inasmuch as I exalted you from the dust and made you leader over my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel sin, provoking me to anger with their sins. Behold, I will consume Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Any one of Baasha who dies in the city, the dogs will eat, and any one of his who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens will eat." You know, dogs and birds love these prophets. They always ate well when the prophet came. And Baasha, verse 5, "Now the rest of the acts of Baasha and what he did and his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And Baasha slept with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah, and Elah his son became king in his place. Moreover, the word of the Lord through the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, also came against Baasha and his household, both because of all the evil which he did in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of his hands in being like the house of Jeroboam, and because he struck it." That is, he struck the house of Jeroboam. Well, as you know, we're in this section of 1 Kings where the kingdom is now divided, and the author of the book is moving his attention from one kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel, down to the southern kingdom of Judah. And now he's going back up to the northern kingdom of Israel, and we will look basically at the lives of two kings, Nadab and Baasha. Last week we were down in the south country, we were down in Judah. We looked at the reigns of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, Abijam, and Asa. And now, since we're going back up into the northern nation of Israel, the author of Kings is going to camp there for a while. He's kind of been moving back and forth, alternating the histories of Israel and Judah. But now he's going to stay in the north, because we will soon come to this very devious and evil couple who will reign on the throne for many years, and that will be King Ahab and his queen Jezebel. And they are such a despicable, ungodly couple that there are many lessons that we must learn from their evil, sinful life. And also, God will raise up one of the greatest prophets of all of history, the prophet Elijah. And he will have a prominent role as he interacts with this evil king and queen. So basically, from this point on, till the end of the book, 1 Kings chapter 22, till we come to the last 13 verses of the book, it will be all about Israel in the north. And then it will switch back down to Judah again at the very end of 1 Kings. And that will launch us into 2 Kings. So this morning we're looking at Nadab and Baasha. Now, if you look at verses 25 through 32, we have the sinful and short reign of Nadab. Let's discuss this gentleman for a moment. We learn in verse 26 and verse 25 also that he is the son of Jeroboam. Jeroboam was the evil king, the first king of Israel in the north, who made those two golden idols, those two golden calves, and launched the whole nation down a path of idolatry. Like father, like son is the sad truth about Nadab. He follows in his father's sins. You can just call him Jeroboam Jr. And if you look at verse 26, it says he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he walked in the way of his father, and in his sin, which he made Israel sin. And that, no doubt, is a reference to these two golden calves that Jeroboam made. And his son Nadab is now walking in Jeroboam, his father's sin. And that is, no doubt, a reference to these two golden calves. The sad thing about this is that those two golden calves are basically never destroyed until Israel as a nation is annihilated. One of them is put in Bethel, the other one is put in Dan, and they continue on throughout the 200-year life of the nation of Israel. They are never destroyed, they are never torn down. They continue to have their influence upon the nation. I think that should teach us a lesson about letting sin get a toehold in our life. Because sin, you see, has its own way of latching hold and has a tenacious grip. It has spikes and cleats and claws to lay hold of our soul, and they're very difficult to eradicate. But for the Spirit of God, they would never be eradicated. But like a tick, sin will bury its head into the flesh of our soul and suck its life and its blood out of us until God removes it. And sin will continue on in the life of this nation. And those two golden calves will continue to have its influence. And it's only by the power of God that the power of sin can be broken. So Nadab, Jeroboam's son, is not only his physical son, but also his spiritual son, for he walks in all of the sins of his father. Notice, secondly, his achievements. Basically, all we learn is that he laid siege, in verse 27, to a city called Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. It's a big whoopee-doo. That's all he did. He laid siege to one city. That's about all he accomplished in his life. And then we are introduced to this man by the name of Baasha in verse 27, son of Ahijah, the house of Issachar, who conspired against him. And while they're laying siege to Gibbethon, he murders Nadab, and he takes the throne for himself. So Nadab rules for a short 2-year period, verse 25. And once Baasha, in verse 28, becomes king, he reigns in the place of Nadab. He is now the king of Israel. We read in verse 29 that he slaughters the entire house of Jeroboam. And if you notice there in verse 29, he does not leave to Jeroboam anyone alive. He kills them all. Women, mothers, children, sons, especially the sons. But he kills off the whole entire family. And so now that brief reign of Jeroboam comes to an end. Jeroboam's dynasty is short-lived. It continues into his son, only one son, and that for only 2 years. And then the whole family tree is chopped down. You see, Jeroboam is like a spiritual cockroach, and Baasha is the God-ordained exterminator. And by God's order, the line of Jeroboam is now extinct. It ends. It's run into a dead end, and it is no more because of his sin of idolatry. There are several things I think that we should learn from this. First off, is that sin, particularly the sin of idolatry, always brings instability. The northern kingdom of Israel is always much more chaotic than the southern kingdom of Judah. For example, in the southern kingdom, there are 20 kings that rule over a 350-year period. All of those kings are from the line of David. One family rules through 20 kings. In the northern kingdom of Israel, its reign is much shorter. Its life of the nation is much shorter, only 200 years. And even though they have 20 kings also, their reigns are comparatively much shorter, and there are 9 different families that control the throne. Where in the southern kingdom, there's only one, the family of David. But in Israel, there are 9 different family regimes because of all the assassinations and all of the revolts and the military uprisings, so that the family that is on the throne changes hands 9 different times. You see the instability that sin and idolatry brings into a kingdom. The turbulence, the chaos. You see, that's the plan of sin. Wherever it gets a stronghold in our life, it will always bring instability. Sin will never let you hang on to your blessings for very long at all. Sin is like a thief. And according to the words of our Lord, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. And I came that they might have life and might have it abundantly. But there's no abundant life where sin is in control. What sin gives, it quickly takes away. Adam and Eve did not have much time to enjoy paradise before sin robbed it from them. Sin always wants to take away from us whatever it can. I read a story recently about the Mandan Indians up in the Dakotas. And in the year 1837, a smallpox epidemic broke out among the white traders on the boat St. Peter's. And while the boat was docked at Fort Clark, an Indian chief stole a blanket from one of the infected deckhands on that boat. The officers found out about it, and they tried to get that blanket back from the Indian chief because it was contaminated with smallpox. But of course, the Indian chief would not have anything to do with them and refused to give it back. But within about 3 days, the Mandans began to get sick. And quickly, hundreds of them were dying every single day. After all was done, out of a tribe of 1,700 Indians, only 30 of them were left because of one sin of stealing one blanket that was contaminated with smallpox. And that is always the desire of sin. It will always want in some way to get into your family or to get into the church or to get into the state or to get into the nation. And whenever sin gets a hold of something, it will always try to destroy it and bring instability and chaos and ruin. It loves to spread and rob us of both life and blessing. And it is the main source of instability in our life is sin. So whenever there are struggles and problems, and again, whether it's in marriages or families or relationships or work or church unity or steadfast growth in grace or the fruit of the Spirit, sin will always try to bring that to a quick end and rob it from you and steal it away. So idolatry in the northern kingdom of Israel plunders it and destroys it and causes one regime change after another because of all the instability and the assassinations. But we also learn, secondly, from this that sin brings judgment from God. You see, sin will always get its reward. Maybe not today, but there is a payday someday, and God is the one writing the check. And you don't mess around with the Ten Commandments, and especially the one about making idols before the worship of God, because God keeps track of all. And other than the blood of Jesus Christ, there is nothing but judgment and wrath ahead of those who violate God's laws. The destruction of Jeroboam's family that we've read about in these verses is no accident. This is no case of friendly fire where God accidentally shoots down one of His own people by mistake. This is a clear, in-your-face judgment sent by God using express mail at the hand of Baasha. Clearly, this is the work of God. God is not passive, but He is in sovereign control of this judgment. Notice, if you will, in verse 29. It says that Baasha struck down all the household of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive until he had destroyed them according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So all of this was according to God's previous prophecy that would occur. God is in control. And let's just briefly look back at this prophecy and see how exactly it came to pass. Turn back to chapter 14, if you will, and look at verse 10. 1 Kings chapter 14, and look at verse 10. And this is the Ahijah the prophet now speaking to Jeroboam. And he says, "Therefore, behold, I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male person, both bond and free in Israel. And I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it is all gone." And then drop down to verse 14. "Moreover, the Lord will raise up for Himself a king over Israel who will cut off the house of Jeroboam this day and from now on." And this all exactly came to pass as God said. Just notice some of the elements of this. In this 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 10, there's nothing about God saying, "I'm going to allow this to happen." It's not, "I will allow it to happen." He says, "I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut it off. I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam." That's not just God standing back and passively watching. God is doing it. God is in control. The event is actually planned in detail. He's going to bring calamity. He's going to cut them off. He's going to sweep them away. And everybody in his house will be annihilated. It's exactly what God said He would do. And even notice the person that He's going to cause to do it in verse 14. I will raise up for myself a king. So God is going to raise up a man who will be the next king. And once he becomes king, he'll annihilate the entire household of Jeroboam. God's doing it all. God is sovereign. So you see, sinners in the hands of a sovereign God. God is using them for His own purpose and His own holy will. And actually, as we see later on, if you caught it when I read back in chapter 16, Baasha, who annihilates the house of Jeroboam, God is now going to take somebody else and annihilate the house of Baasha. Both of these kings, their families will be exterminated and brought into extinction by God. Kind of reminds me of 9/11, when the two World Trade Towers were on fire. And I mean, how many of us can envision that now, just as we were there that day watching it on TV, and the two towers were burning as the planes had crashed in. And then before our eyes, we could not believe it, because the first tower just collapsed. I mean, it just suddenly started collapsing, and there was a big pile of smoke, and the whole tower just collapsed down into dusty ruins. And then a short time later, we couldn't believe it again, because the second tower caught on fire from two-thirds of the way up, now just imploded and caved in and collapsed all the way down to the ground. And that's exactly what the house of Jeroboam and the house of Baasha have done. They come tumbling down under the weight of the fire of God's wrath because of their sin. So that it's all a judgment of God. Matthew Henry said, "Those who resemble others in their sins may expect to resemble them also in their plagues." So that the house of Baasha will suffer the very same judgment that they brought onto the house of Jeroboam. Both houses, like the two towers, will come tumbling down in a matter of time. The truth that we should glean from this portion of Scripture is that God can use any sinner, any time, for any purpose to accomplish His good and holy will. God is sovereign. Sinners are not independent of God. They are subservient to God's holy and righteous and good will. And though we may not be able to understand it all, that is what the text is saying. God is bringing it to pass. God is raising up another king, Baasha, who will annihilate the household of Jeroboam. Then later on, He's going to raise up somebody else to annihilate the house of Baasha. God uses evil men to annihilate their own kind. Kind of like black widow spiders. And when we moved into our house, I have never seen a black widow spider in my whole life until we moved into the house that we moved into back in 1998. And thanks to Mr. Winchester, who unloaded a bunch of wood in our backyard. I have to blame somebody here. No, I probably just came out of the house, but in this wood, there was a black widow spider. And I flipped that thing over just to see if it really was one, and it had one of those hourglass red things on its stomach. It was a black widow spider. But knowing about black widow spiders, what I've been told about them is that once they pair up with a husband and they mate, the black widow spider kills and eats the husband. Now, for Mother's Day, this is not exactly a good thing to emphasize, I realize. And wives, please don't take this to heart. Don't go home and practice this. But the idea is that a black widow will attack and consume its own kind. And that's what God does in raising up evil people that attack and destroy other evil people. He's accomplishing His good and His holy will. And then He holds that sinner that judged the other sinner, He holds that first sinner accountable for his sin and will punish him in like kind. There's an amazing story in the prophet Isaiah about how God is going to raise up Assyria to punish Israel. And so He raises up Assyria. Assyria comes up, comes over and punishes Israel. And then God now comes to Assyria and says, because you attacked my nation, my Israel, I'm going to destroy you. And even though I raise you up to be an axe to chop down the nation of Israel like a tree, I'm now going to take you as an axe and break you and burn you for what you did. You say, well, how can God do that? How can God raise up a sinner, even harden his heart as He did with Pharaoh, use him to discipline and punish others, and then punish him for doing what God had him to do? How do you explain that? Well, Paul did in Romans chapter 9. And this is what he said. You will say to me, why then does he still find fault? For who resists his will? And on the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this, will it? Or does not the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? Sinners in the hands of a sovereign God, accomplishing His good and His holy purpose. So the first truth we should learn from this is that God is using Baasha to punish the house of Jeroboam, particularly his son Nadab. And then later on, He will punish Baasha, not only for his own idolatry, but for being the means of bringing judgment upon Nadab, because God is sovereign. You see, as sinners, there's no one who is innocent in the eyes of God. God is not the author of evil, but God is sovereign over evil. He is sovereign and directs and controls and uses wicked, evil men for His own holy purposes, because He's God. He's the potter. We're the clay. We have no right to challenge Him. The second thing we need to know about this also is that it's important that we know that God is sovereign over evil, and that the evil in our world today is not out of control, but is under control and being used by God's infinitely holy and wise purposes to accomplish His will. Look at what's going on in the world. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. Look at what's going on in China. Look at what's going on in Iran. I mean, you can look at that and you can say, my goodness, the world is out of control. Evil is just on the march and there's nothing to stop it. God is in control. God is in control. And for those who have the faith to believe that, there's a tremendous amount of peace and comfort that comes to our hearts. See, there's great comfort in knowing that when the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans came and robbed everything that Job had, and the fire fell from heaven, and the great wind destroyed the house in which all of his children died in, that God was in control. There's comfort in that. There's comfort in knowing that the jealousy and the evil intentions of Joseph's brother were being directed for God's purpose. There's comfort in that. There's peace, particularly when we're on the end of the meltdown and the destruction and the dust and the ashes. There's grace there to minister to our hearts during that time. So Nadab had a very short, though a very sinful reign. Baasha, who replaced him, who killed him, who destroyed his entire family line, is now on the throne. And what do we learn about Baasha? Well, he is equally sinful, even though he has a long reign, 24 years compared to Nadab's 2 years. Baasha is on the throne for 24 years. Now we read about this in verse 33. That in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha the son of Ahijah became king over all Israel and Tirzah, and reigned 24 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he made Israel sin. Several things about Baasha. He was probably a military man. He's there at Gibbethon back in verse 27 of chapter 15. He is there with his king, Nadab. So he's probably in charge of some of the army. He's a military man to some degree. And so he revolts and conspires against Nadab and puts him to death. We also learn from chapter 16, verse 2, when God, through the prophet Jehu, tells Baasha that he exalted him from the dust, that he was probably a man of common origin, no royalty in his blood at all. So that's about all that we know about Baasha. But it's interesting, we do find that in chapter 15, verse 32, he's at war with Asa all their day. So he's still a military man. He's fighting. We know that about him. And so we find him coming to reign in chapter 15, verse 33. We find him dying in chapter 16, verse 6. And the only thing that separates his coronation and his death is this prophecy made against him by Jehu, the son of Hanani. Now we find that this prophecy is coming against Baasha because of his wickedness. We saw that chapter 15, verse 34. And this is the irony of this, and there's a bit of, this is kind of incredible. God raises up Baasha to destroy Jeroboam because of his idolatry. Now you would think that Baasha would say to himself, wow, maybe I shouldn't worship these two golden images. But you know what he does? He worships the two golden images. This is part of the insanity of sin. This is part of the spiritual blindness where he saw and caused the destruction of Jeroboam's house where it's all idolatry. But he turns around and does exactly the same thing. There is a spiritual blindness that comes upon people. And they don't see the sin of their parents. They don't see the sin of their peers and their friends. And so they repeat and fall into the very same thing. It's like children that see their parents destroyed by drugs, and yet they grow up and they become drug addicts, and they become addicted to cocaine and heroin or crack, and they see others get hooked on them, and they see their lives just disintegrate before their eyes. But they do the very same thing. How can they do that? Because there is a spiritual blindness that prevents them from seeing the truth. Or they've read all about people that are suffering with AIDS because of engaging in immorality outside of marriage. And they see people suffering and dying because of AIDS. And what do? They go out and they engage in the very same thing. The stupidity of sin is just beyond our ability to really comprehend. And haven't we all tasted of that in our own life in one degree or another? So even though he is now king, reigning with a brand new family on the throne, he is repeating the same old sins of Jeroboam, according to chapter 15, verse 34. Well, along comes Jehu in chapter 16. He rebukes him. And even though Baasha will have a long career on the throne, his family also is going to be destroyed because of his idolatry. This prophet Jehu is going to minister in Israel for about 50 years. He's going to have a long ministry. He's also one of the writing prophets because he will write a history book that will be referred to in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 34. So he's a very prominent prophet, this Jehu. But the message behind his prophecy against Baasha is because of your idolatry and because you destroyed the house of Jeroboam, your house is going to be destroyed in similar fashion. And this reference to the dogs and the birds that eat well, that was said with Jeroboam as well. So it's kind of a same song, second verse kind of a situation of judgment. Baasha's death is recorded in verse 6 of chapter 16. He slept with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah. Tirzah is kind of the capital city of this point, at this point, of Israel in the north. And his son Elah will become king. He'll reign for 2 years and he'll be slaughtered also. And so Baasha's house will come to an end also. But again, the only thing between Baasha's coronation and his obituary is this prophetic rebuke. He reigned for 24 years, but the Spirit of God didn't see anything about that worthy of mentioning other than the fact that he destroyed the house of Jeroboam and he fought with Asa all of his life. But there's nothing else significant in his life to mention. A long career, a long time on the throne, relatively speaking, 24 years, but it's counted as if it was nothing in the eyes of the Spirit of God. Nothing's recorded. It's like it's a big blank. 24 years, reigning as king. And no doubt he did many things, but the Spirit of God looked at all of it and said, nothing's worth saying. Nothing's worth recording. There's nothing of value here at all. No details as to his accomplishments. 24 years, no doubt he did more than just twiddling his royal thumbs, but nothing is indicated. What do you think the significance of that is? Well, I suggest to you that possibly what we should learn from this is how easy it is to waste a person's life. I think one of the sad lessons from the life of Baasha, the fact that even though he was on the throne for so long, and yet there's nothing to report about him, is that basically he wasted his life. That he no doubt did many things, but none of it in the eyes of God was worth recording. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity of being down in southern Oklahoma, and there was this old-timey little cemetery that was there. And just a few gravestones were in this thing. And I walked over to it and looked at the tombstones, and they would give the name, and they would give the date of the birth. One of them was 1825. And then a dash, and then the date of their death. And the ones that I was looking at, the death was like 1892 or 1893, an old, old cemetery. I looked at the name and I started wondering, gee, I wonder who this person was. Wasn't any information given about him on his tombstone. He lived a fairly long life. But everything that he did was summarized by that dash between his birth and his death. Nothing said, nothing recorded, nothing of note. And I started thinking how easy it is for us to live our entire life and for it to basically be meaningless and without value in the eyes of God. And how many of us, when we die and we're laid in the grave and a stone is erected, that our whole life is going to be summarized by nothing more than just a dash between our birth and our death. See, nothing in Baasha's life apparently was significant in the eyes of the Spirit of God. And don't mistake the longevity of his reign for a productive life. Well, he may have accomplished a lot of things, but nothing that God thought was noteworthy. In fact, I think in the eyes of God, his life certainly was a complete failure. It was like a house of cards blown down by a slight wind or a pile of chaff which will one day be set on fire on the day of judgment. It's just there and gone. Nothing of significance. Maybe many worldly accomplishments, but that which doesn't really matter in the eyes of God. They're not important when God evaluates the life. You see, one's relationship with God through Jesus Christ is the most important indicator of how useful and how profitable our life will be. And in fact, the whole primary purpose, I think, for the life and reign of Baasha was to be a pawn in the hand of God to accomplish His will and to annihilate the wicked house of Jeroboam. But there is nothing there for God's kingdom, nothing for God's will. Nothing else mattered to the Spirit of God than how He served the Lord in destroying the house of Jeroboam. Makes me stop and wonder how easy it is for us to waste our life and to waste our years and to waste our time and waste our talents given to us by God. It also makes me think, as I apply this to myself personally, how profitable is our life in the eyes of God? The life of Baasha makes us think about really, what is important in our life today? When you think about His reign, it makes us pause and reflect on how we can better focus and clarify the things that are really important, the things that are important in God's eyes, rather than just trying to impress other people. See, who are we trying to please in our life? Is it our parents, our family, our friends, our peers? Well, see, no doubt, Baasha was trying to do that. And yet he was living his life for the wrong set of eyes. He was living them for the eyes of men rather than the eyes of God. And the eyes of God do not value what the eyes of men value. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 7, we're told that God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And what is it that God is looking for in the heart? How is it that we can invest our life so it is profitable and it is pleasing to God and it will merit His reward of grace in heaven? Well, the simple answer is that God honors the life that is lived for Jesus Christ, period. That's the life that He will honor, the life that is lived for Jesus Christ. The life that lives for Christ, the Lord will honor. He will bestow the glory of heaven because of the grace that He has worked in that heart. But those who do not live for Jesus Christ, their life will be summarized by that dash between their birth and their death, and their life will be meaningless and invaluable in the eyes of God. Paul's greatest ambition in his life was to be pleasing to Jesus Christ, for he was looking to the reward of the resurrection. Is that the ambition of our hearts? Is that the drive of our life, to be pleasing to Jesus Christ? Do we desire to invest our life in such a way that we're investing for eternity as opposed to just investing for our own little kingdom and our own little life here on this earth? Well, living for Christ is the heart and soul of what pleases our great God. And this is done day by day, decision by decision, as we seek to submit ourselves to His Lordship and serve Him as our Master and as our King. And when by the grace of God we enter into the presence of God, we, like the 24 elders in the book of Revelation, will cast our crowns before the throne of God. We will praise the Lamb of God because all that we have done in living for Christ, all of our obedience, all of our faith and faithfulness will have been proven to come from His gracious hand. And He will receive the glory for it all. Baasha's life and reign was very long, but it was void of any significance and of meaning. A short life, live for Jesus Christ, will have an incredible value and impact on this world. But that's the key. It's living for Christ. That's the key. That's what will bring meaning and purpose to our life today, to avoid the sad tragedy and the blank and the dash of the life of King Baasha. Well, may God help us all to redeem our time and to learn the lessons from these two sad kings of Israel, that we might better understand God's sovereignty and better guard our hearts, that we might not waste our life like King Baasha. So may God give us grace. Let's close in prayer.